Welcome back to the Something Extra podcast. I'm Lisa Nichols, and I'm so grateful for the leaders who joined us last year. In the second collection, we revisit more standout conversations. Gary Baker offered a powerful perspective on a love people approach. Horst Schultz pushed us to never settle for anything less than excellence. And Johnny Erickson Tata inspired us with her faith, resilience, and calling to serve others. These are stories worth hearing again. Here is part two of our Best of 2025. In this conversation, Lorraine Haywood, CEO and founder of Augustine Talent Group, explains how she assesses cultural fit using a proprietary behavioral analysis that emphasizes the importance of aligning a candidate's hardwired behavior with the team's makeup. Let me ask you this, because sometimes it's not just, you've got to have the competencies. That's table stakes, right? You've got to have the competencies. But what we see is every organization, Lorraine, has a different culture.
Yes.
Has a different culture. So, and then sometimes why people do not work out is because it just was not a good cultural fit. And it could be from either side, right? So what are some of the ways that you assess that piece, good alignment there with culture?
Thank you for asking that. So that's where I'm going to go back to what we call a talent selfie, which is our behavioral analysis, which is how people are wired. So not only do our candidates take it, but our clients take it as well. So our clients take it, and we have them take it by departments, and we build what's called a quilt. So it shows how they measure, and then we compare the candidates to the quilt. So we're first starting with, do they behave alike? Do they think alike? Are they wired alike? And what we found a lot of times, which is interesting, when we've gone into some of our clients and had them all take the test and build these quilts, that they maybe had someone in sales who wasn't wired to be in sales, and they were failing. But then we would like I'm going to use one client as an example. They weren't good in business development, but they fit the quilt of an IR, and then they moved over and they started succeeding and flourishing because that was the seat that was better aligned. So that's one of the ways we try to do with the culture, right? Is first of all, are you aligned? Do you behave and are you wired in a way that fits the team? And then we believe in multiple interviews. We believe in a Zoom first to kind of get to know you. And as I mentioned, part of our package we send to our clients is we record our interviews. We have a list of questions mm-hmm. so you can see the behaviors. And my favorite question is, what questions do you have for us? Because you learn a lot about the questions they ask you. And then we encourage our clients, let's do a Zoom first, then an in-person. And we also encourage a social, which could be a lunch, a happy hour, or dinner. But get the whole team out and let them interview, not the candidate as well. Do we all align? Do we have things in common? Do I want to spend 40, 50 hours a week with this person? Instead of just, we don't just send a resume. We send all of this data that says, hey, we believe this person not only has the competencies as you were speaking to, they have the EQ, and they match your culture. Mm-hmm. Now, do people surprise us? Sometimes, but with all that data, we get it right more often than not.
Yes. Yeah. That is so good. That is so good. Let me ask you this. What are some of the most common hiring mistakes that you see from the organization standpoint? Not hiring you?
Not hiring me. That's the first one. Absolutely. Or hiring you on the technology side. Yes.
Yes.
But other than that, they hire too fast. I do believe in a gut feeling, Lisa, and I think people should go with their guts. But sometimes, especially when you're looking at people in business development at all levels, they're known salespeople, so they can ace an interview. I also believe sometimes, and this is not a knock by any means on education, anybody, but sometimes people put too much emphasis on the school they went to or their GPA. I know in certain fields it's very important, but there are a lot of people who just couldn't afford it. I actually prefer someone who worked all through college because that shows tenacity. It shows their ability to multitask and things like that. So I think it's one, too fast, not doing enough research on the back end and not asking the tough questions. I've said in some of my clients' interviews who just dance around, of course, everything correctly within the law, but dance around tough questions because they don't want to offend someone or maybe don't want the answer to be no. So you have to ask the questions that really dig into who they are, what they're looking for, but where they've been and why they made the decisions they made.
In this clip, we learn that Gary Baker founded Undivided Wealth because he realized the financial advisory industry was missing the people part, leading him to create a holistic guide helping clients use their wealth to truly live life and achieve fulfillment. You founded Undivided Wealth, and I just want to know, like, what sparked that leap? And I think, you know, I know what it is, but I'd love for you to tell our listeners. And it goes back to a lot of what you just talked about and being able to help people.
Yeah. And so what you'll hear a lot of financial advisors talk about when they meet with their clients is they say, we talk about the markets or what's going on in their portfolios, et cetera, for about 10 minutes. And then we start talking about their life for the rest of the time. And that's a very true statement. And the reason why you only talk about 10 minutes is because most people think, well, I don't know that. I don't care to know that. That's why I'm actually working with you. So you guys can figure those things out. And I don't want to be bored for the next 60 minutes or 90 minutes or whatever it is.
Right.
But then what happens is, this is also a unique factor of being a financial advisor, is it's one of the occupations that you actually meet with a client, at least, you know, on a quarterly basis over a long extended period of time. So when you meet somebody over a quarterly basis over a long extended period of time, and they're talking about something that's very private and sensitive to them, their money, they're also open now to talk about everything else that is going on in their life, and anything that they want to do that has real significant meaning at some point in time is going to cost some level of money. So it starts to bridge that gap, you know, funding education, you know, just whatever it may be. And so what I realized is, well, what our industry is missing is the people part, the human part. And so if back to that time, we're spending 10 minutes on the financials, great, nail that, be a black belt in that, understand it, but then also nail and be a black belt in the things that matter most to them, which is the other 60 minutes. So if you can become skilled at understanding who they are, why they exist, what they want to accomplish, where they want to accomplish it, what do they want to leave back? If you can actually become a guide on that side of the equation, in addition to the monetary guide, well, to me, that's the dream. To everybody else, it's like, whatever, glad you're happy doing that. But I mean, that's been my dream since I was 18. And Thankfully I've just spun it into what it is today.
I love it. Well, let me ask you this. You created the Undivided Experience Center from scratch. I've been there multiple times for events. What was the vision behind that, Gary?
So, perfect. So what I've always envisioned is, I don't want to help people think about life. I want to help people live life. And so, you know, if you think about our building, you know, 10,000 square feet, 2,500 of it is the wealth management part. So we cover their investment plan, we cover their financial plan. And then in their financial plan, they start to give us the things that they want to accomplish in life. Well, great. How do I do that? How do I start my business? How do I sell my business? How do I change my career? How do I, you know, lead my company better? How do I give back to the community? All the how do I do and live the important things of life start to come up. Well, then I said, this is great. Let's build an experience center that allows them to have a taste of that experience of something they want to do. It becomes like a catalyst. So if they want to try something, great, let's put it into the plan, understand it. But then let's just literally walk out of our wealth management doors and into our experience center doors and put it into practice, make a connection, launch a business, you know, change your career, meet with one of our life consultants or, you know, business consultants or what have you. Let's put it into action. So I care more about people. I do care about how much money someone has, of course, right? And I want to grow that, of course. But I care 10 times more what they can do with it and what that money can do, frankly, for others. So it's not even just what it can do for them. That's the first step. That's the success part. But the fulfillment part is, but what can that success then do for others? And that's when the fulfillment comes in. So if we can do all of that in one place.
In our next clip, Matt Nichols, Chief Digital Innovation Officer at Technology Partners, discusses the relentless pace of change in IT, emphasizing that while AI is the immediate focus, the massive $7 trillion infrastructure investment needed to support AI's demand is the critical future challenge. Your team has been really blessed. You've worked with billion-dollar enterprises, designing, building custom solutions that power the backbone of operations. Iconic brands, really iconic brands, Matt. From MasterCard to Panera Bread to, you know, oil pipelines and power grids. I mean, truly, you guys have worked with some of the best teams out there. It has been really a blessing. But I want to get into more about what your team is doing today. And so I've got lots of questions for you. Really, you know, everything in IT, if you're in IT, there's one thing we can all agree on. The change is incredible. The rapid pace by which technology is changing. Light speed.
Yeah. You know,
AI, cybersecurity, infrastructure, modernization. So let me ask you this. What are you scrambling to get ahead of right now?
You're 100% right about constant change. If you ever have a vision in your mind as a young professional that in IT, you're going to get to a point to where you can just be settled and be in a leadership position and coast, that will never happen. I remember when my dad told me, I brought to him some new technology and he said, you know, I'm just kind of tired of learning new things. And I'm like, well, you're done then. You're done, bro.
Right.
So you always have to be ready for that change. And, you know, what I'm really excited about, what I'm really focused on, the big change ahead of us, you know, obviously AI is top of the heap. Everybody's figuring out how they can leverage AI the best in a responsible way, right? A safe way, secure way, but really harness that power. I remember the first time I used GPT when it came out. And my first thought was, this is going to change the world more than the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Things are going to be completely different. And but what a lot of people aren't thinking about is the infrastructure that it's going to take to support the demand for AI. The compute needs for AI is it's very, very expensive. And the demand is going through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the data centers that we're going to have to build to support the demand in our country alone, we're going to have to double in the next four and a half years, double that, which is going to be hundreds and hundreds of data centers, which means a lot of construction and cooling. How are we going to cool the data centers? We got to get water there. We got to get power there. We have to manufacture chips. There's a $7 trillion investment in this level of infrastructure. Trillion with a T. Now we need the companies to be able to step up and do that. We need those mm-hmm. infrastructure companies to be able to step up and do that. And so I want to take everything that I've learned and everything that my team's done over the years. And by the way, going back to your comment earlier about good teams,
yes.
If I had $100, I would bet all $100 on my team because they're so good. They're so good.
Best of the best.
But I want to take everything we've learned. How can we use digital innovation to support those infrastructure efforts that are going to support the new critical infrastructure? The new critical infrastructure is AI and those data mm-hmm. centers, because if those go down, every business in our country will in one way or another be.
It's going to be affected.
It's going to be affected, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you think about the critical infrastructure that's going to support the critical infrastructure, that's where our focus is right now.
Yeah. And I've got a lot more questions around that. And I'm excited to talk about it more. Matt, you have said that nothing compares to the moment we're entering into right now. What do you mean by that?
100%. Yeah. I mean, if you think about the technology arc that's happened since the creation of the wheel, right? Wheel, fast forward to the internet, like long time. The arc between those two bits of technology, I think, may be less than the arc that we're about to experience in the very near future. Because if you think about AI, include robotics, of course.
Yes.
And then quantum computing, you know, and nanobots, like you marry those things together with just some of the things that we've heard about quantum computing just in the last few weeks and month about the computational power and speed, it's going to drastically change the world in ways that I think that we can't even really comprehend right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to be alive in this time and be a part of that.
In June, I had the privilege to sit down with Horst Schulte, the co-founder of the Ritz-Carlton, who details that the non-negotiables or gold standards of the luxury hotel brand were derived from deeply understanding customer expectations and ensuring excellence in every detail. lead, you know, the things that are going to get you there, right? So excellence is one of those. But when you founded the Ritz-Carlton, what were those non-negotiables?
Well, excellence, or, no, all non-negotiables have to be accomplished with excellence. Well, let me put it this way. A great company understands the expectation of their market relative to their product. See, it's not about me. It's about the market. So we had careful studies done by J.D. Power, in fact. What is the expectation in the high market segment for an excellent, for a luxury hotel? What is the expectation of experience? Then we determined those expectations. There was things that you can imagine, for example, exceptional cleanliness.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's exceptional cleanliness, I had to say, how do I make sure and what are the processes to assure that I have the cleanest rooms in the industry? If I want to be the best in the world, I have to have an expectation like that superior to my competition.
Yes.
So I actually created a team to say, how do we create a room that is actually cleaner than anybody else's room? And I knew my hotel's rooms were cleaner than anybody else's room. I knew mm-hmm. that based yes. on the process that we created. We knew that the customer, seemingly unimportant thing, like one of the negotiated number 16, I know the number still, number 16 was, if a guest asks for direction, never point, take him there.
Take him there. Mm-hmm.
And so we developed 20 non-negotiables, or which were called gold standards or service principles, whatever. I call them non-negotiables. And we made sure every employee understood them, and we kept them alive. We repeated them once a day. We discussed them. And or when I called them non-negotiable, because I happened to call my, early on at that time, my general manager in Shanghai, because something happened. And the general manager said, well, Horst, you don't understand Shanghai. Yeah. I said, and I want to. That's why I have you there. But those 20 points are non-negotiable,
mm-hmm.
no matter where yeah. you are, because that's what Ritz-Carlton is.
Mm.
So instead of gold standard, I call them non-negotiable.
Yes.
They cannot be negotiated.
Well, Horst, and I'm thinking to myself, it's the feeling that you're leaving with your guest. So I know that I read this somewhere. It may have been in your book or something else. But even when someone pulled up, you know, the people that were helping with the luggage would look at the luggage tag.
You read it in my book. Yes, you read it in my book.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
the friendliness.
You know, what is the expectation of a customer? The customer wants to have good service. What is service? What is service? And you know, I'm consult with a lot of people now. I talk to a lot of people. And many companies I work with that are actually in the service industry, when you ask them to define service, they cannot. Service starts the instant you make contact. It doesn't matter if that is on the internet or in person. It doesn't matter. That instant when the contacted us in any form should be an exceptional moment.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So service starts with an exceptional greeting. Welcome. Not hi. If I say hi to you, I say we're equal.
Right.
But if I say, good morning, ma'am. Welcome. How are you today? I'm saying, I respect you. At the same time, I'm stating, though, that I'm professional if I say that, if I treat you right.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step of service is a fine greeting. The second step of service is, it's all about you. It's me helping you to make the best decisions about my product. I'm helping you relative to my product. I'm here for you relative to my product. And that's the second step. And the third step is farewell. Thank you for allowing me to serve you. That's the moments of service. And that first impression, by the way, is an essential one. Welcome.
Next, I was honored to get to speak with Johnny Erickson Tata, who shares how the Johnny and Friends Ministry goes beyond providing wheelchairs and holding family retreats, by establishing Johnny's Houses in 16 locations worldwide to meet the holistic needs of people with disabilities. Johnny, I just want to mention this for our listeners. You have got so many ministries. I was telling my husband this morning, you've got Wheels for the World. You've already kind of talked about that, but I think you've given over 300,000 wheelchairs so far, maybe more than that. You've got the family retreats, the getaways, an international family retreat, an internship program, the Johnny's House programs that are all over the world. Tell us more. Tell us a little bit about that, Johnny.
Well, giving wheelchairs is great. And of course, holding retreats for special needs families in Peru or Thailand or El Salvador or Eastern Europe, Cuba, Africa, Uganda. It's great to hold family retreats. I mean, these people live in such dire conditions that they need more than a wheelchair. They need much more than a week of rest and respite. They need medical supplies. They need to be scholarshiped for a surgery. They need hygiene kits. They need diaper pads for their incontinent child with cerebral palsy. They need so much more. And so we have 16 Johnny's Houses located around the world in places like Nepal and Uganda and Serbia, Brazil, and more. And these are places that are usually located near a hospital. We scholarship children with disabilities to have surgeries. We provide food for the family. We provide the necessary medical supplies such as chucks and diapers and urinary care products and things of that sort. We do Bible studies and Bible counseling for husbands and wives who are having a tough time. We also do micro enterprise so that young people with disabilities can learn a trade. In fact, in our Johnny's House in El Salvador, there are young adults with Down syndrome who pack up our coffee bags and are part of shipping them out. So we really try to address the holistic needs of those with disabilities. And it's the legacy program at Johnny and Friends. It's got my name on it, and I can't believe I am so privileged, so honored, so grateful. What did I do to ever deserve something like that? You know, to help the least of the brethren, the most unfortunate. It's just, to me, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It is wonderful. And I'm just, I'm teary-eyed just listening to you. But again, but God.
But God.
But God, right, Johnny? He has plans that are more than we can hope or imagine.
Yes.
So I'm just grateful to you. Well, let me ask you just this, and then I want to get into I just want you to talk a little bit about your latest book. But, you know, you've been at the helm of Johnny and Friends for a long time now. You know, what are some of those key leadership lessons that you've learned leading this organization?
Well, I have served as the CEO of Johnny and Friends for well over 4.5 decades. And in that time, I have had to forget everything about personal power leading to effective leadership. Because confidence and charisma and chutzpah, it counts for little in the long haul. It really does. The most effective leaders, they don't rise to power in spite of their weaknesses. They lead with power through their weaknesses because they have yielded, as you put it, they have surrendered themselves wholly to God. And I think the better that a leader tells his story of grace in his life, the better a leader is transparent with his executive team and with his staff, the more he invites others to consider their own stories of redemption, and the more he endears himself to those he is leading. So I think those are the two biggest lessons. And of course, how God loves to leverage weakness and minimize power to get his work done so that when the work is accomplished, he gets the glory.
Yes.
He gets the glory. You said that earlier, and I love it.
In our last clip, Michael Steinberg, founder of the Steinberg Group, explains that his company's philosophy is rooted in being good partners and giving locally to enhance the community.
So, Michael, I know that you and Carol in 2012 formed the Steinberg Group. What is TSG's philosophy and what does it mean in practice?
You know, our philosophy is to be good partners. You know, live locally, give locally, be part of the community where you are. I always had that feeling. You know, it was important because, you know, it's nice to make money. I like making money. But I also think it's important something bigger than just making money. What you do with the money and how you can enhance the community you live in. And I could live anywhere in the United States. I choose to live in St. Louis. And, you know, it's a region in 25 years ago, somehow someone asked me to join the Regional Business Council, Kathy Osborne.
Yes.
And it changed my life again. You know, another opportunity to be part of the region.
Mm-hmm.
But, really, I like that. And that's what TSG is about. You know, it's great to have these shopping centers. And yes, I have 2 million square feet in, Chesterfield, and I built the factory. But how do we, you know, help people? You know, like a little unknown fact is that we give away $100,000 a year to nonprofits. I call them the orphan nonprofits from the factory. Every concert we, you know, have people, we donate money, you know, so we can make a difference. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do that. I don't know any concert venue in America that does this.
Mm-hmm. So the factory gives away $100,000 a year? I did not realize that. Yeah, and the factory, for those of you, because we have people all over the world that listen, Michael, for those of you who do not live in St. Louis, the factory is such a cool concert venue. Beautiful, beautiful in Chesterfield. I love that venue.
I do too. And, you know, I'm proud of it. But
yes.
Again, you know, as I said, I can't write, but I can certainly figure things out. And I, you know, I feel like I'm an artist. I can be the artist and the framer. I like being the artist. But, you know, I built this from scratch. And then people, you know, looked at me like I was absolutely crazy when I did this. And, you know, I think it's important to give back. I think it's important to enhance people's lives. You know, I was watching Jimmy Valvino's speech the other day. You know, it's, you know, it's, I think, the 20th anniversary, maybe it's even the 40th when he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said he wakes up and does three things in the morning. You know, those aren't the three things I would do. But you know what? Pick three things that make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? That's really what I try to do. And that's one of the things about TSG. How do we make it a better place? How do we enhance, you know, if it's Firestone, Colorado, we give money up there. How do we do things, you know? I mean, I don't want to hear that MoDOT or that CDOT doesn't maintain something. We'll just go out and clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need someone to do that and put art, and, you know, art invokes emotion, things like that. But more importantly, you know, the savings. When I do, I'm good at development. So a lot of these nonprofits, I'll go in and do the development, and I've saved these nonprofits $300 or $400 million. You know, they would have to go raise. And then I've raised, you know, $300 million, because if I step up and they see my name on it, they say, well, we should give. You know, there was a mentor of mine by the name of Tommy Green, and he said one day, well, stop giving anonymously. Put your name on it so people can see. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's important to me. And that's what I'm trying to get people to, you know, I call it the converging ripple theory. Mm-hmm. I'm in the art, so I built this piece of art that's 40 foot by 40 foot in Omaha on a blank wall. And it moves in the wind. It's road signs that Boris Bailey did. And he said to me, well, what do you think we should call it? I said, converging ripples. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? I said, well, it's like a still pond. You know, you can take a little pebble and throw it in. It creates a ripple.
Mm-hmm.
Take a boulder and throw it in. It creates a ripple. It doesn't matter how big the ripple is. It's the fact that you do a ripple.
Yes.
And you make a difference. And that's all I ask. And that's what I'm trying to encourage people to make a difference and help people's lives.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc. 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.